How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one, go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com. Got it.
Step two, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three, play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step four, unleash your excitement.
Woohoo!
Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com.
Terms and conditions apply. You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own podcast is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads just like this. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start your new podcast for free today at RSS.com.
Short Rounds.
Welcome back to the Unknown Soldiers Podcast. I am your host, James Hauser, and it is Short Round time. Today's episode is another one of those little historical events that isn't big enough for a full episode, doesn't really fit into the other episodes, but is too important to be forgotten. If this is anything, it's kind of a postscript to the Boudicca episode. So, in episode 63, Furies of Britannia, I talked about the Roman conquest of Britain and the rebellion of Queen Boudicca of the Iceni, and I pretty much ended the story with the final defeat of her uprising. Well, guys, the story of the Roman conquest of Britannia didn't exactly end there. Rome wasn't finished. They had a lot more conquering to do. So I considered putting the story I'm telling today in that episode, but it would have absolutely ruined the narrative flow. Like, I'm a historian, but I'm also a storyteller. And if I talked about Boudicca's rebellion, then I rambled on for 45 minutes about a bunch of people who weren't Boudicca, and then I was like, okay, here's why Boudicca's important, that wouldn't have felt right. I may not be the most academic historian, but unlike some of them, I understand story structure. So anyway, today's episode is about the Roman conquests of Britain after Boudicca, focusing on one guy, Gnaeus Julius Agricola, the Roman commander who led the legions to the very ends of the earth. But his campaigns, his life, and his story were almost lost to history. The only reason we know about them at all is the Roman historian Tacitus, who happened to be his son-in-law. And to me, that's the interesting part of this story. Just like in the episodes about the Roman-Jewish War, the historian is actually our main character here. This is honestly a strangely touching story about how Tacitus didn't want his wife's father, a man he loved and respected, to become an unknown soldier. And so he wrote the only account we have of the Roman invasion of Scotland, of much of the ethnographic history of Britannia during the Roman period, and of, like, this is the first guy to really write in detail about Scotland before the 4th century AD. It is an invaluable resource, and we only have it because of one man's grief for someone he admired. The only reason we know about Agricola, the Battle of Mons Graupius, and the Roman legion's march to the edge of the world. As always, this is not just history, but military history. There is some dark and bloody stuff going on. Podcast is PG-13, language is mostly clean, content is not. All my sources and some maps will be on my website, unknownsoldierspodcast.com, so if you want to fact check me, go right ahead. Finally, any errors, mispronunciations, or mistakes are my own. Everything I'm telling you is accurate to the best of my knowledge. This was a real story with real people who don't deserve to be unknown soldiers. Publius Cornelius Tacitus, better known as just Tacitus, lived from 56 to 120 AD. He was one of the greatest historians of ancient Rome, and his works are invaluable. Tacitus's writings stand out for their detail, even-handedness, and depth. We only have fragments of his writings, and each of them is worth 100 times its weight in gold. Tacitus's book Germania is our main source for what the Romans knew about the Germanic peoples, our only real source for any of the tribes in northern Europe before 200 AD. Tacitus also wrote the Annals and the Histories of Imperial Rome, which cover a century of Roman history. Half of the chapters of each of those, the Annals and the Histories, are lost, probably forever, but what remains are just this amazing critical source for the reigns of Tiberius, Caligula, Claudius, Nero, a whole bunch of guys. The annals are also our main source for Boudica's uprising and the war against the Druids. And Tacitus's annals contain one of the first mentions of Jesus Christ and the Christians outside of the Bible. This is that mention of Jesus I mentioned back in the Jewish War Part 1, or Wailing Walls Part 1, where Tacitus mentions Jesus by the by as that guy who got executed, and now all these crazy people are here in Rome now. That's where this comes from. This guy is one of the most important ancient historians of the Roman Empire and the peoples it conquered. Tacitus himself was a high-ranking Roman aristocrat. He probably commanded a legion around 89 to 93 AD and served as consul in 97 AD. Pliny the Elder records that Tacitus gave the funeral oration for a Roman commander in 97 AD, and all of Rome praised his rhetorical performance, so he was an important person in his own time. But Tacitus's first work dealt with a personal tragedy, the death of his father-in-law. When Tacitus was about 21 years old, before he started his career in politics and the army, he married a woman named Julia Agricola. It sounds like he loved her dearly, and his wife's father, Gnaeus Julius Agricola, became his hero, his icon, the guy he looked up to as a model of what a man and a leader and a Roman should be. When Agricola died, then, Tacitus wrote a biography of his father-in-law. It was titled De Vita et Moribus Julii Agricolae, The Life and Death of Julius Agricola. The biography described Agricola's life, his career, his personal tragedies, and his achievements, and at the end, Tacitus mourns his death. And one of those achievements was Agricola's conquest of northern Britannia, including modern-day Scotland. And this source is it. This is, like, a couple of other Roman sources mention Agricola's campaigns in passing. It's like two sentences. But this is the only reason we know anything about what I'm about to tell you, Tacitus' biography of his father-in-law. And that means we do have to take it with a grain of salt, because Tacitus is obviously trying to make his father-in-law sound good. But we do have to take it. So when I refer to Tacitus' biography, I will refer to it as the Agricola, and the man himself as just Agricola. And guys, don't mispronounce this name. You look at this name, and it looks like it's pronounced Agricola. It's not a vegan soft drink. Like, imagine if there was a spinach-flavored seltzer water or something. That's what this would be called. No, it's pronounced Agricola. Anyway. Gnaeus Julius Agricola was born around 40 AD into one of Rome's leading aristocratic families. His father was executed by Caligula soon after his son was born, with Caligula just being a psychopath. But Agricola's mother, Julia Procilla, was a champion who raised her son despite being a single mother. Okay, she was a Roman aristocrat, so she wasn't, like, poor or anything, but let's not get carried away here. But it sounds like Agricola's mother had a huge impact on his life. Tacitus says,
I remember how he would often tell us that in his early manhood he would have drunk deeper of philosophy than a Roman and a senator properly may, if his mother in her prudence had not dampened the fire of his passion.
I mean, it happens, right? You're a young man, you keep reading Reddit threads, and your mom comes in like, boy, you best get your face off that computer and go outside. Same thing.
He came away from philosophy with its hardest lesson learned, a sense of balance.
Like many young Roman noblemen, Agricola joined the army when he was of age, and he was posted to Britannia as a tribune, a junior officer, in 58 AD, when he was 18 years old. And he performed well enough that he joined the staff of the governor, a guy named Suetonius Paulinus. So Agricola was by Suetonius's side throughout Boudica's rebellion. Like, the main Roman general who defeated Boudica, Agricola is on his staff, and he sees all of this. He probably fought against the Druids on Anglesey and at the Battle of Watling Street. That's a heck of a first deployment for a brand new lieutenant. He's 20 and 21, and he's at Boudica's Rebellion. This is your first duty station. Agricola returned to Rome in 62 AD, got married, then served as an administrator in Anatolia and Spain, moving up the traditional ladder of promotion for a young nobleman in the Roman Empire. When the Year of the Four Emperors broke out in 69 AD, Agricola made the smart move of siding very early on with Vespasian. but he suffered a personal tragedy during the Civil War.
The following year dealt a grievous blow to his heart and home. The men of Otho's army murdered Agricola's mother on her estate and pillaged the estate and a large part of her fortune.
That's what Tacitus says. Not even Roman aristocrats or aristocratic women were safe when civil war was unleashed and the armies got out of control. Tacitus's Histories of Imperial Rome is our main source for the Year of the Four Emperors, and Tacitus deplored this period as a time of cruelty and murder, a direct consequence of Nero's tyranny. So as we can see, Agricola lost both his parents to the tyranny of bad rulers and the consequences of that misrule. And remember, Tacitus blamed the Boudica Rebellion not on Roman imperial practice per se, but on the evils of Nero's rule in particular. Tacitus loathed tyranny, contrasting the bad emperors of times before him, like Caligula and Nero and later Domitian during his own lifetime, with better emperors like Vespasian and Nerva and Trajan. Tacitus actually talks about how he lacked freedom of speech. He lacked the ability to write his mind during the reign of Domitian, and when Nerva took the throne, he was able to write whatever he wanted and he wouldn't be censored for it. Agricola's career took off under Vespasian's regime. He commanded the 20th Legion in Britain for a couple of years and the province of Aquitaine after that. Finally, he returned to Rome for a term as consul, the highest ranking office a Roman nobleman could achieve without actually being emperor. It was during his consulship in 76 AD that Agricola's daughter Julia married a nice, awkward young man named Cornelius Tacitus. Tacitus was probably about 21 when this marriage occurred, Julia was probably about 16, and, you know, okay, sure, not great by our standards, but based on what we heard in the past and what we're going to hear in like the next episode I do, man, this age gap is amazing. That's only 5 years and they're both semi in the same range. We're not going to get this lucky again for a long time, guys. We're going to the medieval period. You don't want age gap discourse in the medieval period. Anyway, soon after he celebrated his daughter's wedding, the now 37-year-old Gnaeus Julius Agricola was given a new assignment. The Emperor Vespasian had appointed him as the Roman governor of Britannia. Ever since the Boudica Rebellion in AD 60 or 61, the Roman province of Britannia had kind of stagnated. It had been expanding for a long time and then just kind of stopped. The governors that followed Suetonius Paulinus for the first few years were a bunch of lazy, corrupt non-entities who barely did anything. They were so boring that, according to Tacitus,
there was serious trouble with mutiny, for the soldiers, accustomed to campaigning, ran riot in peace.
Yeah, man, I'm telling you guys, bored soldiers are always a problem. You gotta keep them busy, even if they're just doing nonsense, because the bored soldiers are the ones that get up to trouble. And when the Year of the Four Emperors hit in 69 AD, lots of the legions declared for one side or the other, messing up everything even more, and the British natives saw an opportunity. That the whole Year of the Four Emperors period is like a time when the British natives start to rise up and claw back some of their territory. The tribes in Wales rose up, the Ordovices and the Silures, and they took a bunch of territory. They even reoccupied the island of Mona, where the Druid groves had been. But the biggest threat came from Rome's ally, the Brigantes to the north. Queen Cartimandua's ex-husband Venutius launched another uprising to overthrow his wife. He'd launched one like 20 years earlier, and he's launching another one now. I guess the divorce mediation didn't work. Tacitus implies that she had shacked up with a common warrior, which Venutius took as an insult. Plus, Venutius sort of led the anti-Roman faction of the Brigantes, the ones who were like, hey, this is not okay, these people need to be driven off the island, versus Cartimandua was pro-Roman faction. They're like, nah, they're cool, they're our friends. So with several of the legions on Britannia being sucked into the civil war, the local Roman forces were unable to subdue the uprising of the Brigantes. They were able to march in there and rescue Cartimandua herself, but not put down the rebellion. Venutius ruled the Brigantes for several years as an independent British kingdom at war with Rome. But with Emperor Vespasian on the throne, things started to quiet down a bit, and things got rolling in Britannia again. Vespasian appointed a new governor named Quintus Petilius Cerealis, the same guy whose 9th Legion had been eviscerated by Boudica. I guess it didn't hurt his career that much because he shows up here now and he's governor and he's doing a pretty good job. So it sounds like Vespasian figured out that Cerealis wasn't really to blame for the disaster. After several years of hard fighting, Cerealis crushed the Brigantes and finally brought northern England, what is now northern England, under direct Roman control. It sounds like Agricola, who was the commander of the 20th Legion at this time, was involved in at least part of these campaigns. The Romans built a strong fortress in northern England to keep an eye on the area, called Eboricum, aka modern-day York. What the Romans did not do was restore Cartamandua to her throne. She disappears from the sources after they rescue her in 69 AD. It sounds like the Romans said, "Carty girl, we can't keep rescuing you from your ex. We bailed you out once, but twice? Nah, girl, this ain't gonna work out." Historians theorize that Cartamandua was sent back to Rome in exile, where who knows, maybe she ran into Caratacus at the bathhouse or something. Like a meet cute, like a fun enemies to lovers story. They're both probably in their 60s. But I digress. The next few Roman governors spent most of their time campaigning in Wales and northwest England. They founded new fortresses at Deva, modern-day Chester, and Luguvalium, modern-day Carlisle. By 78, the Romans had conquered South Wales and opened up valuable lead and gold mining operations in the mountains, so Britannia was finally returning some kind of profit. And that was the situation when Agricola arrived in 77 AD. Wales was partially conquered and northern England had recently been subdued, but there was still a lot of work to do. Agricola's first order of business in 77 AD was dealing with Wales. According to Tacitus, shortly before he got there, the Ordo Vices had basically wiped out a squadron of cavalry stationed in their territory. So Agricola decided to go take care of that. Even though it was very close to winter, outside of the campaigning season, he moved and he moved quickly. Agricola gathered a few legionary detachments and some auxiliary units, tracked the Ordo Vices down, and hit them like a hammer. Tacitus says that Agricola fought in the front rank of his army to encourage his troops, and they defeated the Welsh insurgents. Agricola followed up this victory with another attack on the island of Mona, which the Celtic Britons had reoccupied during the Year of the Four Emperors. Remember, this is the famous Druid Island. Once again, Agricola used the famous Batavian cavalry to swim the gap between the Welsh mainland and the island, surprising the defenders. How is this a surprise? You gotta wonder why the Britons keep being surprised by this. It's been 40 years. They have seen these amphibious horsey boys time and again, and every time the Batavians swim across something they're not supposed to be able to swim across, the Britons are like, "Damn it, I forgot they could do that." Get it? This is this kind of thing, man. It's this kind of thing. Come on. The defenders of Mona sued for peace, and Tacitus, when Tacitus records Suetonius Paulinus' conquest, Tacitus does not have Agricola like destroying the groves again. Agricola just lets them be at peace and leaves them alone. Tacitus notes how much Agricola had accomplished in just a few months of his governorship. He also describes how he accelerated the Romanization of the province, showing that he was also a good administrator.
"To induce a hitherto scattered, uncivilized, and violence-prone people to grow used to peace and comfort, Agricola encouraged individuals and assisted communities to build temples, public squares, and proper houses. He trained the sons of the leading men in the liberal arts. Our national dress came into favor, and the toga was seen everywhere. In their innocence, they called this civilization, when in fact, it was part of their enslavement."
Oh yeah, that's empire doing empire things. We're gonna make y'all civilized, teach you to live the right way. We've seen this show before, haven't we? Interesting that Tacitus calls it part of their enslavement, like it's a negative thing. Tacitus saw Roman civilization and luxury as ruining the barbarians, robbing them of all their positive qualities, like their toughness and their martial virtues and their love of freedom. These were qualities that Tacitus felt was lacking in the Rome of his day. He's criticizing his own empire for corrupting these other people, for making these previously free people into a bunch of pleasure-addicted slaves like the average Roman. But Agricola also made sure his administration was honest and fair, preventing any corruption or abuses of power like the one that had sparked Boudicca's rebellion. He even let up on taxes and distributed grain to hungry locals in times of famine.
By checking these abuses in his very first year of office, Agricola gave men reason to love and honor peace, which, through the negligence or arrogance of former governors, had been feared as much as war.
But as the year 78 AD dawned, Agricola looked north, past the boundaries of Roman rule in northern England, to the wild, distant lands where no civilized man had ever walked. Britannia had been mysterious to the Romans, but northern Britannia, the region of modern-day Scotland, was mysterious to the rest of the Britons. The Romans called it after one of the native tribes. They called it Caledonia. The Romans had literally no idea what lay up here. Like, they don't know. They had no idea what lay beyond the modern English-Scottish border. They weren't even sure if Britannia was an island, or if it just kept going. It was uncharted territory, unmapped, unseen. For all intents and purposes, it was off the edge of the map. For all they knew, it might literally be the ends of the earth. But when Agricola arrived in Britannia in 78 AD, he had his orders from the Emperor Vespasian. Agricola would lead his legions into that darkness and take the Roman army to the edge of the world. Agricola spent 78 AD laying the groundwork for his campaigns in the north. This included, as the Romans always do, paving the way with diplomacy, trying to establish client kings and local allies in the area he expected to conquer. Tacitus mentions several tribes north of the frontiers accepting this deal to become a Roman client king. These were probably the Selgove and the Votadini, tribes of southern Scotland around modern-day Edinburgh and Dumfries. But Agricola also spent lots of time laying the logistic foundations of his invasion. He was building those Roman roads all the way up from York and from Chester, all the way up to the border, to prepare that logistic line for his invasion. Archaeologists have found several Roman forts built during this period, along the main north-south road into Scotland. These were outposts built by Agricola to guard his supply routes during his invasion of the north. In 79 AD, Agricola's legions started to push north into uncharted territory, all the way up to the Tay River, which flows through modern-day Perth. The weather was appalling, with the Romans marching north and drenching British rainstorms through dark Scottish forests and marshes and down narrow tracks, but their conquest was successful. Multiple powerful tribes bent the knee to Rome, including the Dumnoni, who lived near modern-day Perth and Fife. As the legions always did, Agricola's men built defensive marching camps as they advanced. The marching camps of the Roman legions had a very specific layout and size, so archaeologists can find the old remnants and outlines of these camps and use them to track the progress of a Roman army on campaign. That's how archaeologists figured out about the Roman siege of Masada and confirmed Josephus' story about that siege, because they found the legionary camps and estimated the size of the Roman army sent to besiege Masada. So in the 1970s, for instance, Scottish archaeologists were doing surveys by air, because you can spot these things much better by air than you can on the ground, identified two legionary marching camps in modern-day Perthshire, probably Agricola's camps on his march north. Tacitus tells us that Agricola spent the year 80 securing the areas of lowland Scotland that he had already conquered. This is confirmed by the archaeological discovery of small Roman forts all over Scotland, southern Scotland, mostly dated to Agricola's invasion. We can literally see the progress of the legions into Scotland year after year by finding these forts and marching camps and seeing Agricola's control expanding north. But Agricola didn't move any farther north than 80 AD, probably because of a change back in Rome. The Emperor Vespasian had died and been succeeded by his son Titus, the conqueror of Jerusalem. And Agricola wasn't sure if the new emperor would have new orders for him. Titus was his own man. He might have a different idea of what he wanted to do out here than his father did. And it does sound like Titus considered ending the campaign and marking off the new boundary of Britannia here, at the narrowest point of Britain. Tacitus says,
"For the Clota and Bodotria, carried far inland by the tides of opposite seas, are separated by a narrow neck of land."
One of the really big problems with ancient sources, especially in areas that were not super civilized at the time, civilized quote-unquote, is that geography gets really, really sketchy. the Clota and the Bodotria. What is he talking about? Where are those? He's probably referring, based on the context, to the Firth of Clyde and the Firth of Forth. Those two rivers that hit the center of Scotland and just pinch it off to a very narrow isthmus right in the middle. So that's the choke point that separates northern from southern Scotland. And if you are a conqueror trying to establish a firm east-west boundary for your new Britannia province, the area between the Firth of Clyde and the Firth of Forth would be your best, most obvious place. A river and mountain line easily defensible by a string of forts or even a wall. Part of this line would have included, it probably would have been right across where modern-day Stirling is. And Stirling is the historic fortress choke point for passing between northern and southern Scotland anyway. So the Romans probably would have put a fort on there. By the way, Stirling Castle went there a couple months ago. That's why there's a castle there. It is an amazing tour. You would love Stirling Castle. I think it's much better than Edinburgh Castle. Yeah, I know. We know, James. You went to Scotland. You went on vacation. Blah, 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 blah. I get it. Okay, I'm moving on. But the invasion of Scotland would not stop at this very obvious line. Maybe Titus ordered Agricola to complete the conquest of all Britannia. Or maybe Agricola did it on his own. Maybe he just wanted to get to the very edge of the world and see what was there. In 81 AD, his fifth year of campaigning, Agricola secured his western flank, occupying the southwest coastline of Scotland. Tacitus records that Agricola also tried to get some information about the large island to the west that the Romans called Hibernia. This was, of course, Ireland. The Romans never did invade or occupy any part of Ireland. They had contact and trade with the tribes there, but nothing else. Tacitus says that his father-in-law thought a conquest would be easy.
I often heard Agricola say that Hibernia could be reduced and held by a single legion and a few auxiliaries.
But even an ambitious general like Agricola wasn't going to go off on an unsanctioned invasion of a big-ass island without imperial approval. He still had the rest of Scotland to conquer. Agricola was probably back at his headquarters in Carlisle for the winter when he learned that the Roman Emperor Titus had also died. So we've gone through two Roman emperors during his tenure. The new emperor, Titus's younger brother Domitian, ordered Agricola to continue the conquest of Caledonia. Now, Tacitus does not like Domitian, and we're going to find out why. He viewed Domitian as a tyrant. And Domitian, it sounds like, ordered Agricola to continue the conquest, not for any real, tangible reason, but to enhance his own military glory. Like Claudius several decades before him, Domitian lacked the military glory he needed to bolster his regime and was trying to get it somewhere. And what better way than to complete the conquest of Britannia? In 82 AD, Agricola marched his legions into northeast Scotland, towards Aberdeen and Peterhead. His army was flanked by a large fleet of galleys rowing up the east coast, scouting out harbors and delivering supplies, using naval logistics to keep his army supplied on this long march to the north. This is actually the exact same route and supply method that the Duke of Cumberland used in the 45 during the Jacobite Wars, 1700 years later, on his way to the Battle of Culloden. It sounds like there was an inter-service rivalry between the legions and the navy. Tacitus says,
"Each side boasted, as soldiers will, of its own exploits and adventures, and matched the perilous depth of woods and mountains against the hazard of storms and tides, the victories over enemies on land against the conquest of ocean."
Agricola's fleet actually pushed way ahead of the army, possibly making it all the way up to the Moray Firth near Inverness. Splashing through the cold blue waters of the North Sea, the Roman sailors would have looked out at the peaks of the highlands rising in the distance, places no Roman had ever laid eyes on. But Agricola's legions were encountering a lot more resistance this far north as they started venturing into the highlands. The Caledonians began to attack the Roman forts constantly, and they even staged a large night attack on the 9th Legion. Tacitus records the Caledonians striking panic into the legionary camp because they catch it by surprise, cutting down the sentries and breaking inside the palisade. The fight was already well underway when Agricola learned of the 9th Legion's peril. He gathered his other two legions and came to the rescue, driving the natives back in the nick of time. Tacitus records that this victory over the Caledonians made the Roman army very confident and eager to fight the final battle.
Fired with self-confidence and the glory of this victory, the army clamored that nothing could bar its brave advance. We must drive deeper and deeper into Caledonia and fight battle after battle until we have reached the end of Britannia.
As Agricola's legions moved farther north every year, the tribes of modern-day Scotland realized they had to unite. Only by joining together in a coalition could they hope to hold back the legions. Tacitus records embassies and treaties going out from the Caledonii especially, calling all the fighting men of Scotland to join together against the invader from the south. They were about to challenge the Romans in a decisive battle. Poor barbarians, always going for the decisive battle. Even as the tribes assembled, though, Agricola's family experienced a horrible tragedy. Tacitus records,
"At the beginning of the next summer, Agricola suffered a grievous personal loss in the death of his son who had been born the year before."
Yeah, infant mortality was no joke back in these days. But there's often an argument that parents didn't get too attached to their children before they got to a certain age, which sounds like it might make sense, but Tacitus makes it clear that Agricola and his wife Domitia Decidiana definitely felt this loss very deeply. They had lost their first son in around 63 AD, and now they had lost their second. Their only surviving child, as far as we know, was Tacitus's wife Julia. Tacitus describes Agricola as taking the news very heavily, and again, we have to remember, this is a historian describing the death of his infant brother-in-law. It must have been his wife's grief, too. That was her baby brother. And Tacitus, in these pages, is very sensitive to his wife's feelings and her grief about her brother and her father. So this is very personal for Tacitus. It was a tragedy for him and these people that he loved. He described how his father-in-law, who he saw more and more as like his own father, dealt with the loss.
"This cruel blow drew from him neither the ostentatious stoicism of the strong man, nor the loud expressions of grief that belong to women. The conduct of war was the means he had to relieve his sorrow."
Like many men who have trouble with their emotions, dealing with death or despair, Agricola threw himself into his work. The Roman general put his grief for his infant son aside and led his legions north for their final campaign against the Caledonians, the one that would take them to the edge of the world. The Caledonians prepared for their confrontation with Agricola at a strong defensive position, a place Tacitus identifies as Mons Graupius. And we have no idea where this is. Graupius isn't even a word in Latin or the Celtic languages. It might be a corruption or a miscopy of Mons Crypius, which might come from the Celtic word for a comb. And the Celts often used that word to describe a ridgeline or what a ridgeline looked like. So that would make Mons Crypius, literally, the hill of the ridge, which is super helpful. Yep, that's a very hilly ridge, a very ridgy hill. But there is a place in near northeastern Scotland that might be a ridgy hill. Modern historians believe the most likely site for this battle was a place called Benahee, a mountain range about 24 miles northwest of Aberdeen, easily visible from the A96 highway. Benahee is a large ridge with four summits, very similar to what a rooster's comb might have looked like, and it is a central location with defensible ground, very accessible from all over Scotland, a good spot to rally the Highland warriors to fight the Romans. Wherever Mons Graupius was, Agricola led his legions there sometime in the summer of 83 AD. All of his logistics work and slow, steady progress had paid off. The legions were able to march quickly without a heavy baggage train, a long steel serpent threading its way through the hills and mountains of eastern Scotland. The Caledonians awaited the Romans at Mons Graupius. Tacitus says that they had mustered about 30,000 men, and more were arriving all the time. They arrayed themselves in multiple battle lines up the side of the mountain, covering the hilltops like a swarm of ants. The mountains of Benahee, if that's where the battle took place, overlook a vast open area, like you can see everything from the bottom or the top. You can see miles in every direction. So this battle would have taken place in something like a natural amphitheater. To the Romans, the Caledonians must look like a surging sea of aliens, barely human, with their blue-painted bodies and their long red hair and their beards, their shields with swirling symbols, their iron swords, and of course their war chariots clattering along in front of the army, with dudes just on them just screaming and waving their swords at them. This massive Celtic army, the ancestors of William Wallace and Robert the Bruce and the Highlanders and the Scots, come to do battle with the Roman invader. Tacitus records that one of their many leaders was a war chief named Calgacus, a brave and highborn leader. And he gave a speech to the Caledonian army. Of course, you can't trust an ancient speech, and even Tacitus admits this. He says that he was told that the speech was something like this. Here's part of what Tacitus says Calgacus said.
"This day of your splendid rally will be the dawn of freedom for all of Britannia. You have mustered to a man, and to a man you are free. There are no lands behind us, and even the sea is menaced by the Roman fleet. We, the last men of the earth, and the last of the free."
Even the Caledonians knew that they lay at the edge of the world. They were the last people in Britannia that the Romans hadn't conquered. Behind them was only the sea.
"Beyond us lies no other nation, nothing but the Romans, whose arrogance no submission or moderation can elude. Robbers of the world, having by their universal plunder exhausted the land, they rifle the deep. If the enemy be rich, they are rapacious. If he be poor, they lust for dominion. Neither the East nor the West has been able to satisfy them. Alone among men, they covet with equal eagerness poverty and riches. To robbery, slaughter, plunder, they give the lying name of empire. They make a desert and call it peace."
"They make a desert and call it peace" is a famous quote from this passage, one of the most apt descriptions of empire you'll ever find. Later on in the speech, Calgacus references Boudica's rebellion.
"Abandon all hope of mercy and take courage, whether it is life or honor you hold most dear. The Iceni, with only a woman to lead them, burned a colony and stormed a camp, and if success had not made them careless, might have cast off the yoke. But we, uncorrupted and unconquered, are fighting to retain our freedom, not regain it. Let us prove at the first clash of arms what kind of men Caledonia has."
After he was finished with his speech, the Celts gave a wild cheer and prepared for their battle against the Romans. Agricola formed his soldiers up to face the Caledonians. He spread his battle line very thin to match the enormous numbers of the Caledonians. He placed 8,000 auxiliary infantry in the center and 3,000 cavalry on the flanks, but he kept all the legionary infantry, the actual Roman citizen soldiers, the famous legions, in front of his camp, away from the battle. They were back there to watch, just in case, but they weren't going to be in the battle. Agricola wanted to defeat the Caledonians with only the auxiliaries if he could. The misconception about the Roman auxiliary troops is that they were like the second string, not as good or as high quality as the legionaries. Like, you got the legionaries, and then you got these other guys. But the auxiliaries were a core component of every Roman army. Almost all the Roman cavalry was auxiliary cavalry, and even a lot of the infantry. The auxilia weren't citizens. They were usually recruited from the provinces. So these units were full of Spaniards and Gauls and Germans and other imperial subjects. Once you finished your auxiliary service, like 20 years or so, you would get Roman citizenship, which was a gigantic prize for you and your children. So serving the auxiliary unit was a great way for Rome to integrate conquered peoples into its society, and a great way for them to get the full benefits of Roman citizenship. Tacitus makes reference to the fact that even some Britons were now part of these Roman auxiliary units. But these auxiliary units were, the auxilia were not second string. They were trained, disciplined, and organized like the legions. And some of Agricola's auxiliary cohorts at Mons Graupius were even equipped as heavy infantry, similar to the legionaries. It sounds like they got, like, not quite as good weapons and armor. Like, they still had the swords, but their armor was almost all still chainmail when a lot of the actual legionaries had the new Lorica segmentata, the famous segmented scaled armor that you see in every depiction of the Roman legions. The auxilia are still using the old chainmail. And they're also, their shields were also oval and not square like the core Roman legionaries. But these guys were still essentially armed and equipped and trained as heavy infantry legionaries. Tacitus specifically mentions units of Batavian and Tungrian heavy infantry from the modern-day Netherlands and Belgium performing extremely well in this battle. Agricola would have watched Calgacus give his speech, and then he gave one of his own. And given how close he was to Tacitus, this may be one of the only times that you can kind of trust an ancient speech. Tacitus might have worked really hard to get this one right. This is some of what Tacitus says Agricola said.
"This is the seventh year, comrades, that by the valor and blessings of Rome you have been conquering Britannia. In all these campaigns I have had no complaint of my men, nor you of your general. We grasp the farthest regions of Britannia. How often on the march, when you were making your weary way over marshes, mountains, and rivers, have I heard the bravest of you exclaim, 'When shall we find the enemy?' Now they come. The field lies open for valor. It would be no mean feat to fall where land and nature end."
Agricola told them that this would be their last battle of the campaign. The enemy had come out in the open, exactly where the Roman army always wanted them. "We've come farther than anyone before us. You are on land that no Roman has trod. Now here we are at the edge of the world." Agricola took his place on foot at the far right flank of his battle line and awaited the Caledonian attack. The Battle of Mons Graupius began with both sides lobbing missile weapons at each other, the Caledonians clattering around in their chariots and throwing their spears, the Romans in their ordered ranks tossing javelins at the enemy. The Celts blocked most of the javelins with their shields, but the Roman javelin was specially designed to get lodged in an enemy's shield and weigh it down, forcing many warriors to drop the only protection they had. Once the missile exchange was over, Agricola ordered his battle line to advance. 4 cohorts of Batavians and 2 of Tungrians. He told them to get into melee range and fight it out at sword point. The close ranks of auxiliaries moved slowly, unstoppably, up the rocky Scottish mountainside, chainmail clanking, feet stamping in perfect order.
"The Batavians, striking blow after blow, pushing with the bosses of their shields and stabbing at their enemies' faces, routed the men on the plain and began to push the battle uphill."
The Romans were fighting a literal uphill battle, starting from the low ground and grinding their way up. The Caledonians had a great defensive position, but this was the Roman army. The other auxilia units charged forward to join in the attack, and soon the front ranks of the Caledonian army were being driven back as this thin, armored line of Roman infantry starts grinding its way up the mountain. Then the cavalry charged in, having routed the chariots, but they were halted by the rough ground and the fierce resistance from the tribesmen. Tacitus describes panic-stricken horses pulling riderless chariots across the battlefield, small bands of Roman cavalry or chariots galloping into the flanks or rear of the armies. The Caledonians on top of the hill, remember they're in multiple battle lines, hadn't been engaged yet, and they saw their lines being pushed back up the mountain, and so they decided to make a flank attack, trying to get behind the Romans as they moved up. But Agricola had anticipated this and held a few squadrons of cavalry in reserve. So when the massive Celtic flank attack swoops down from the mountain and tries to curl in on the Roman line, Agricola unleashes his cavalry against the flank attack and scatters it to the four winds. This finally shattered the Celtic army, and they fled in every direction. The Romans pursued.
"The spectacle that followed over the open country was awe-inspiring and grim. Our men kept pursuing, capturing some and then killing them as others appeared. Everywhere were weapons, bodies, mangled limbs, and soil soaked with blood."
The pursuit lasted until nightfall. The next morning, when the sun rose, the hills were quiet. The Caledonian army had melted away into the mountains and forests as if it had never existed. As the Highlanders always do when they were defeated in battle, they went to their mountain strongholds. The Battle of Mons Graupius, the Britons' last stand at the edge of the world, was over. Tacitus records that 10,000 Caledonians were killed, almost certainly a huge exaggeration, for the loss of only 360 Roman soldiers. And the Roman legions themselves hadn't done any fighting at all. the auxilia alone had carried the day. The Romans stayed at Mons Graupius for several days to loot the bodies and tally up their own losses. Then Tacitus claims that Agricola marched into somewhere vague. He described him as marching down into the northern extremities, which to me sounds like probably the area of Inverness. So the Romans almost certainly did reach the area of Inverness and the central highlands. Their return march from this was slow, leisurely, almost swaggering, to display their confidence after their decisive victory. The Romans may have even passed up the Great Glen through Loch Ness and Glencoe on their way back to the frontier. By November 83 AD, the army was back in its winter quarters. Agricola's campaigns had reached their climax. For the first time, all of Britannia had been put under the shadow of the Roman sword. Agricola ordered one final display of Roman power in 83 AD. His fleet sailed around the very tip of Britain and back down the west coast to Roman territory. There are Roman poems that reference the fleet reaching a place called Thule that bars the western waves where Hyperion is ever weary. The island of Thule that is described in this poem, that several Roman sources do reference, is probably Orkney or the biggest of the Shetland Isles. So these are the first Romans to see like these very small islands at the very, very tip of Scotland. When the Roman fleet returned, they had confirmed what no one else had known for sure until now, that Britannia was in fact an island. Tacitus says explicitly that Agricola's campaigns were the first confirmation that nothing else lay beyond the coastline of Scotland, that they really had reached the ends of the earth. News of Agricola's conquest reached Rome by the winter of 83 AD, to mixed reception. Agricola was officially rewarded with the triumphal decoration, though not a full triumph, and a statue was erected in his honor. But he was relieved of his command in Britannia almost immediately after the Battle of Mons Graupius, and most of his conquests wouldn't last that long anyway. It sounds like the Emperor Domitian had grown jealous of Agricola's victories in Scotland, since he had been trying and failing to win his own big victories in Germania for the last couple of years. Domitian was an autocratic, image-obsessed ruler, Tacitus hated him, and he was becoming more tyrannical over time, in contrast to the relatively benign reigns of his father and brother. Well, Vespasian and Titus were benign if you weren't Jewish. And with his own lack of military glory, it seems like Domitian saw Agricola as a threat. So Agricola returned to Rome, and Roman control over Scotland started to slip away. We have no historical sources that tell us exactly what happened after Agricola's recall. Like, this is when the historical record starts to go blank for a while. But most of the forts above the Firth of Forth and the Firth of Clyde were abandoned in the first couple of years. And by 87 AD, the frontier had been pulled all the way back into England, the line of Carlisle and Corbridge a few miles south of the Scottish-English border. The Romans had conquered Scotland and then abandoned it. Why did they do this? I think it was just too much to hold. It was a bridge too far. It would have taken a huge number of troops and resources to hold Caledonia long term, and those were needed elsewhere. Even during Domitian's reign, he pulled at least one legion out of Britannia to send it to a different spot for a war he wanted to fight, and the reduced garrison of Britannia just wasn't big enough to control Scotland and the rest of the island. Pulling back to a defensible border was a strategic choice. The Romans didn't see anything of value worth holding north of that line. So the legions sat on their new frontier watching the wild lands of Caledonia to the north. One of our best archaeological finds from this period is the fort of Vindolanda, where we have found writing tablets that date from 90 to 110 AD. Again, these are like a valuable little window into what life was like on a distant Roman fort for about 20 years or so. They reveal a lot about Roman military culture, garrison life, the officers' wives and their drama, trade and logistics, and just generally what it was like to be stationed at a Roman outpost. There were still expeditions against the tribes north of the frontier, but nothing like Agricola's campaigns, even though the Caledonian tribes remained a constant threat. It sounds like there was some kind of disaster in 105 AD. It's not mentioned in the Roman histories at all, but archaeologists have found burned fortresses and skeletons at a place called Tremontium in southeastern Scotland, So this is something that definitely happened. There's like definitely a battle here that destroyed a Roman outpost or fortress, but it's not mentioned in the records at all. A few years later, in AD 120, the 9th Legion suddenly stops being mentioned in Roman records. The 9th had been around forever. It had been stationed in Britain since the initial invasion. And the mystery of the missing or lost 9th Legion has fueled conspiracy theories and novels and movies ever since. Some novels even have them going into a subterranean world or trapped in another dimension or an alternative reality. The fantasy author Jim Butcher's Codex Alera novels have them transported to a fantasy world where they get magical powers and found the new empire. I like the Codex Alera novels. I think Codex Alera, Codex Alera. I'm probably pronouncing it wrong, man. I read it. I didn't hear it. Now, there's a lot of things that could have happened to the 9th Legion. Some of them likely, some of them not. There's some evidence that it might pop up in Batavia or along the Rhine in 122, but that's unclear by far. Or it may just have been disbanded. Maybe they're like, we don't need another legion up here, let's disband it. But some historians believe the 9th Legion was destroyed in a disastrous battle somewhere in Caledonia. There's no evidence for that, but it's possible. And that might explain what happened a couple years later. Because only a couple years after the 9th Legion disappeared from the records, in AD 122, the Emperor Hadrian came personally to Britannia, the first reigning emperor to visit the island since Claudius. And he began the construction of a wall along the northern frontier of the province. By the time it was finished, Hadrian's wall was 73 miles long, a stone wall with ditches in front of it and behind it, with forts and towers and turrets all along its length. This is basically like just a smaller version of the Great Wall of China, just across the northern edge of the Roman province of Britannia. Hadrian intended the wall to be the permanent border. He claimed that he had been instructed by the gods that the Roman Empire should stay intact, never breaching beyond its current borders again. Look, this right here, this is the line. This is our side, that is their side. No more, pools closed, we're not doing this again. The remnants of Hadrian's Wall, because it lasted for centuries, are a popular tourist attraction to this day. Many of the forts have been excavated and open to the public. It's very common to go to Britain and see Hadrian's Wall. George R. R. Martin also explicitly based the wall from Game of Thrones on Hadrian's Wall. You don't have to guess about this. You don't think maybe it's inspired? George R. R. Martin said this directly. This was the upper limit of civilization, manned for centuries by a grizzled garrison looking out at the wild lands to the north, the lands beyond the wall. And for all that, 20 years later, the Emperor Antoninus Pius decided to move the border north again. In 142, he had the Antonine Wall built, from the Firth of Clyde to the Firth of Forth, exactly where Tacitus said would be a great northern border for the province. Antoninus Pius probably did this to keep the Caledonian raids at greater length from the settled parts of Britannia. But the Antonine Wall was only held for 20 years, so after that the Romans pulled back to Hadrian's Wall, and that would be the border until the very end of Roman Britain. Roman Britain would finally vanish in 410 AD when it became the first province to be permanently abandoned during the fall of the Roman Empire. The Battle of Mons Graupius had been the high water mark of Roman conquest. Except for one campaign in, I think, in like the 200s AD, when the Emperor Septimius Severus marched up into Caledonia once, he didn't get as far as Agricola. No Roman army would ever again venture as far north as General Agricola's troops did, on their way into the wild lands of Caledonia. Agricola died in 93 AD, at the age of 53, a decade after his campaigns in Scotland. It's possible that he died of illness, but it was widely believed, and some people still believe, that he was poisoned by the Emperor Domitian. Tacitus certainly seems to have believed that. Domitian was unpopular and paranoid. Agricola was a successful, popular general, widely respected and admired. Tacitus claims that a few months before Agricola died, the Roman people had been clamoring for him to assume a military command in Germany to stop the raiding of the tribes, which Domitian had signally failed to do. So Domitian saw Agricola as a threat to his power. He had to go, according to Tacitus. And Tacitus reviled Domitian as an authoritarian tyrant, And if he really believed that the emperor had Agricola killed, that was probably a big part of the reason. So Tacitus viewed Agricola as not only a great Roman general, but also, like Agricola's mother and father, a victim of imperial tyranny. He saw him as a good man in an era of bad men, a brave and noble Roman in a world where so many of them were corrupt and degenerate and cruel. And at the end of the life and death of Julius Agricola, Tacitus talks openly about his grief and pain at the loss of his father-in-law. It's a very, very personal ending to this history. It's honestly surprising coming from a source so ancient to feel this resonate so strongly.
The end of his life was a bitter blow to us and a sorrow to his friends. You could see at a glance that he was a good man. You were tempted to believe him a great one. Cut off though he was in the midst of his prime, measured by glory, his life was absolutely complete.
Tacitus never fails to mention in his epitaph that Agricola left behind a wife and a daughter that loved him very much, and he really seems to have wanted to write about their grief too and about how much they missed him. Tacitus was posted out in the province at the time that Agricola died, probably commanding his legion, and so he and his wife weren't able to be there for her father's last days. Tacitus even addresses Agricola directly in this next passage, calling him father. After all, Agricola had no sons left. Tacitus was the closest thing he had.
Your daughter and I have suffered more than the pang of a father's loss, for we grieve that we could not tend your illness, cheer your failing powers, and take our fill of your look and embrace. We could not have failed to catch some last commands, some words to be engraved on our hearts forever. This is our special sorrow, that through our long absence from Rome, we lost you 4 years before you died. All, more than all, dear father, was assuredly done to honor you by the devoted wife at your side. But there were tears due to you that were not shed, and as light failed, there was something for which your darkening eyes looked in vain.
Isn't this a very strange way to end a historical narrative with something so obviously personal?
All that we loved in Agricola, all that we esteemed, abided and shall abide in the hearts of men. For many men of old will be lost in oblivion, their name and fame forgotten. Agricola's story has been told to history, and so, handed down, he will live.
Tacitus is literally saying, I don't want this man to be forgotten. That's why I'm writing this. And despite that, the Agricola was almost lost forever. Very few copies of Tacitus's biography survived the ages. For a long time, we only knew of one, copied in a giant book or a codex, hidden away in an abbey in Germany, an abbey in Hersfeld. The book also contained the only surviving copy of Tacitus's Germania, and some other non-Tacitus works as well. Several Renaissance historians heard rumor that a copy of the Agricola and the Germania existed, and they spent decades trying to track it down. Some of them finally got a hold of it and copied it, which is good because the Hersfeld Codex vanishes after that and is never seen again. It is the slimmest of chances this work survived. There is this tiny, tiny thread of events that led to the Agricola surviving into the modern day. There have been two manuscripts allegedly discovered since then, starting in around the 19th century, so we know of only three copies of this text that even survived the Middle Ages. Period. So again, it is amazing we know anything about ancient history. It's incredible that we know the first thing about Agricola and the Roman conquest of Scotland, however brief it was. And we would know nothing at all if a Roman historian hadn't set out one day to write a grief-stricken biography of his father-in-law to keep him from being an unknown soldier. And I guess somehow he succeeded. Tacitus literally says he wrote the Agricola so that the old man wouldn't be forgotten, and this gave us our only historical source for the Roman conquest of Scotland, and like a whole bunch of other stuff about Britannia and Ireland that would have been lost forever. All because one man decided to write a biography, an epitaph, for another man who was like a father to him, a man he loved and admired, a man who led the Roman army to the very edge of the world. Thanks for listening today. If you like what you've heard today, tell your friends about it. If you don't like it, tell your enemies. Please review the podcast on Spotify, the Apple Store, or whatever service you use, just to boost it to your fellow listeners. If you want to check out my sources or some handy maps, they are all on my website at unknownsoldierspodcast.com. If you want to contribute to my book fund, I have a donate button there as well. The best ways to reach me are on my page on Facebook or at unknownsoldierspodcast@gmail.com. As always, I love to hear your feedback and your commentary, even if it's just kind words. Finally, guys, we are done with the Romans for now. See you in 3 to 4 weeks, probably four, for our trip to medieval England, where we get to talk about knights and castles and all kinds of fun stuff, including more age gap discourse, because we know we love some age gap discourse when we talk about history. See you down the road for episode 64, where we're going to meet a knight that some have described as the greatest who ever lived, a guy named William Marshall. Only here on Unknown Soldiers.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
You're listening to a podcast right now, driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own podcast is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads just like this. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start your new podcast for free today at RSS.com.